Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 229 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Donny O'Rourke takes us to Edinburgh in August for a Lunasa harvest festival, but one of culture, not of crops. Following Donny, Tiffany Murray flees the overfamiliar but still creatively disabling complaints of a despondent writer by escaping to the strange new world of Iceland and its music. First, here's Donny O'Rourke with Lunasa.
Without fires and feasting, it's probably not a Celtic festival. On the 1st of August, with the harvest underway, at the midpoint between the summer solstice and the autumn equinox, it was the moment to celebrate another of the four holy days in the seasonal calendar. Since it is almost a fortnight until the glorious 12th, the hijinks will not feature that delectable low flyer, the grouse. But the ritual repast will not lack flavour at this time of repletion and plenitude, when ripeness really is all. Such seasonal ceremonies usually marked interstices, elisions as opposed to collisions, neither one thing nor the other, quite. Tonight, in Scotland's capital, there is already a scent, slight yet discernible, of autumn in the balmy breeze. Dunedin, despite its beguilingly romantic Gaelic alias, was a fastness for Angles and Picts. It does, however, know how to throw a party in August. A summer party. August certainly starts off as summer. Parisians and Romans provide proof as their cities undergo the evacuation that precedes vacation. By month's end, though, even they can hear the hints the flowers are dropping with their petals. Amongst the arbours of Prince's Street, within days, the first leaves will fall. Before all that, the harvest. There are plays to gather in, thousands of them, concerts to winnow, recitals to reap, comedians to thresh, overripe metaphors to pick and pickle. And on the tented lawns of swanky Charlotte Square, a cornucopia of a book festival, fruits of the mind and spirit to see us through the winter to come. I was the book festival's poet in residence, a post sponsored by the Scotsman, for which I composed to deadline a daily ditty. Autumn puts the gust in August, the wind smells of stale pale ale, the castle goes up in fireworks smoke, mine's a double in this RLS tale. Some cities are born festive, some achieve festivity, others have festivals thrust upon them. Before it became a twinkle in the shrewd artistic and commercial eye of the Viennese impresario Rudolf Bing, Edinburgh had been as festive as a blocked drain. In the parks on the Sabbath, the swings were chained up. If people enjoyed themselves at all, it was usually by accident. Occasionally, they would send out for a comedian from Glasgow, now there's a festive city, or knit using coloured wool, or practice frowning in the window of a shut shop. Everybody looked as if their hamster had died. Glasgow would have been too ugly and working class for Bing. Anyway, it preferred the Bing who could sing, and would have gatecrashed any cultural bash to which it had not been invited. Glaswegian party pieces would have been loud, vulgar, and subversive. If Glasgow had had a castle on a hill, it would have worn it like a party hat. Edinburgh was content to be a backdrop, to provide a mise-en-scene, to play host by proxy, to look gorgeous and keep its mouth shut. The cash registers went bing, and the rest is history. Mind you, for a financial centre, Edinburgh isn't always reliably astute at counting beans. No one will ever know what the Parliament finally cost to construct. The overspend was fabula. You must be joking, has become an existential creed de coeur. What do you get when you combine a farce with a tragedy? Edinburgh's trams. Lay the tracks, lift the tracks, and repeat whilst watching money burn. The city's punning slogan is inspiring capital. And to be fair, it does inspire artists as well as investors, though not perhaps in that order. Edinburgh's left-leaning artists, with some reinforcements from Glasgow, were determined to be in Rudy's picture postcard. Their creative words and actions were not initially welcomed. Marginalised, though never marginal, their will prevailed. The Fringe went on to become the world's largest arts festival. Eventually, the locals cheered, and cheered up. Had Edinburgh in August been the whole span of my days, concerts and recitals, plays and cabarets, and she to share each shindig there, how could desire demur? On the first night of the festival, with the castle framing her. Edinburgh is one heck of a handsome town. Two towns, in fact, the old and the new. Historically a bipolar binary borough, socially schizoid and self-divided. Small wonder the author of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde grew up here. Stevenson was doucely domiciled in the elegant townhouse that still bespeaks quietly confident, unperturbed prosperity on Heriot Row, one of the new town's toniest terraces. Law student and poet, his classes and carousing took place on the darker side of Princes Street. The old town's dens and dunnies proffered irresistible distraction. In Scotland, barristers are called advocates and writers to the signet. In the disreputable old town, this respectable new town lad learned to be a writer of a different stamp. His debauches took place on or just off the Royal Mile that links castle and palace. Holyrood, opposite our Parliament, is at the bottom of this cobbled stretch of the High Street, almost impassable at festival time, when it teems with tourists, leafleters, performers, and the occasional stuck, irked local who has forgotten that this is now a no-go-to-my-show zone, rather than the picturesque medieval thoroughfare familiar to those who abide here. What few of the August visitors realise is that the new town is the really royal quarter of a country once dismissively styled North Britain. Laid out in the form of the Union Jack, the street names honour the Hanoverian nobility, the aforementioned Charlotte, Rose, who bestowed her moniker on a street renowned for the quantity and quality of its pubs, and most contentiously, German Geordie's brother, Butcher Cumberland, ruthless refuser of quarter at Culloden. For over a decade, first as reporter and director, then as executive producer in charge, I covered the festival first for STV, then the BBC, finding time to review for both the Scotsman and the Herald. As a schoolboy, I had ventured forth from Glasgow to trawl church, school and Masonic Hall, cellars and garrets, venues less structurally sound than the script for a medical student's review, taking in and being taken in, suffering for their art. Attending on spec an heroically abysmal, epically atrocious one-man show, a desecration of the church in which it was being staged, my school debating partner and I seemed at first to comprise the entire audience, until, upon the actor's appearance, a middle-aged woman literally took a pew. We were too teenagely timid to walk out. At the long, long, long awaited interval, all three of us bade the shouty charlatan farewell. Shaking her head, Madame caught my sheepish eye. I know, and I'm his mother. Back then, festival goers in search of princely entertainment had to kiss a lot of frogs. Standards, rents and ticket prices have since gone up and up, and stand-ups off the telly now dominate a less diverse artistic ecology. Under leaky roofs in unprepossessing venues, from performers who slept on floors, I learned to seek excellence in unlikely places. Now we trust the brand rather than our instincts. Talent lacks an obscurity to emerge from. I have often performed on the Fringe, mostly solo, but sometimes with other writers or musicians. Upstairs in the tiny temporary auditorium at Valvona and Crawler, Elm Rose, long-established Italian deli, bar and cafe, songwriter Joel Bowman and I mounted a cabaret on a theme suggested by one of my poems, Love of Scotland and a Scotland of Love. We wanted to celebrate a country whose hearts, minds, borders and doors are open, a nation with a flag made from a kiss, the X that marks our spot, a land made not by natives but by inhabitants, a people who know but will never be shown or put in their place, where life starts and ends with love. August showcases that compassionate consensus. The festival is a focus and locus for celebration as much as celebration. Before the film festival ill-advisedly shifted to June, I was fortunate enough to interview many actors and directors I admired, along with some I didn't. During the official festival, an actor read my poems and read them well, not thesping things up, eschewing hamminess or histrionics in the intimately proportioned St. Cecilia's Hall. But I do love the flappy, snappy marquees and garden party atmosphere of Charlotte Square and the shady, airy yurt which serves as green room and retreat. At the book festival, I have read, chaired, interviewed, and sat in panels. When a song was wanted for its closing ceilidh, a finale to my stint as topical troubadour, I used for its title the lovely Lowland Scots and English word Lammas, the southern equivalent of Lunasa, that other festival replete with shared collective plenty, grace, gratitude, and the songs and stories of the Fili, bards and Shanachies of the tribe. In Edinburgh, in August, this month of gathering, membership of the tribe of those who write and read is open to all. Another summer's over, the curtains all come down, a festival addiction for an old soul town. When the calendars turn full circle, I'll be back in Charlotte Square, and you'll be where your dreams go next, while I think of you and drink to you there. And now it's Lunasa again. Happy harvesting.
That was Donny O'Rourke. You can find out more about Donny on the RLF website. Next, here's Tiffany Murray with Breakpoint.
It's a -5, which my phone tells me feels like -10, and I'm watching a raven croak from a dim streetlight. It's 11 a.m, but dark. The raven puffs himself out, feathers capturing, hugging the air. He's determined. I am too. I've travelled to Iceland in winter to write. Ridiculous, I know. I'm house-sitting for a friend of a friend, a privilege. I know. It's almost Christmas. I'm missing family, and this act is one of desperation. A -5 that feels like -10, with sunrise at 11:45 a.m. and sunset at 3:45 p.m. I found it's too cold and dark to run away from this borrowed desk. And as spellbinding as Reykjavik is, it's too expensive to venture out. You don't drink, you don't eat too much, but it's free to write here. This is my breaking point. We all know it. If you're listening to this, you're probably a writer. It creeps up slowly, that disconnect between the words on the page, the time they take, the business of publishing and earning a living. We don't need to read the recent Arts Council report on literary fiction, that nebulous and unhelpful term, to feel the pinch. For a while, we convince ourselves that earning a living from writing doesn't matter. It's not the point. The writing has to be done after the day job, in those moments where we should be living our own lives with friends, with family, you know, not locked up in a borrowed basement flat in a -5 that's a -10 in Reykjavik. That conundrum. Still, it's hard to say something like this without thinking, oh, stop bloody moaning. Because writers do moan. Social media has brought it out in us, I think. Being a writer is a choice. And it's not hard, they say. You're not a nurse, a doctor, a miner, a candlestick maker. Writing is, that word again, a privilege. Still, at home, in the cluttered spare room between teaching jobs and day jobs, this litany of, it's not hard, it's not hard, it's not hard, writing is not hard, wasn't working. I had dabbled, the worst word for a writer. I had sketched, but I hadn't written properly. I hadn't stuck with and sweated through a whole project for, oh, I have to admit this, 18 months. I had lost my trigger, that unfettered run of the imagination where you think anything can happen, and it's thrilling. I live in a forest, but I hadn't got lost in the woods of narrative and clawed my way through the dark bracken, because writing a novel is a bit like that, isn't it? Did that metaphor work? Maybe not. I had lost my oomph, the staying power that then coaxes and tames this unfettered trigger over months, over years, because we all know a book can take that long, longer. My first novel came out in 2004, a lifetime ago. My second in 2010, 6 years of day jobs, you see, and my third in 2014. Happy Accidents, Diamond Star Halo, Sugar Hall. I'll say their names because they deserve to be named, not because of any particular popular worth, but because, yes, I'm proud of them. I'd be an idiot not to be. And I'm not shrinking from that. But my last novel, Sugar Hall, was quiet. Oh, we've all heard that awful little skirting word. Or maybe not all of us have, but some of us. Don't worry. We all have a quiet book, other writers, though not publishers, will tell us. Oh, yes, my third novel was rather quiet, but I felt my voice needed the rest. Right, I see. The trouble was, to me, Sugar Hall was my loudest, and so to the breaking point. But there was good news in this, I thought. At last I'd come to the end of all the nonsense. The comment is free, the we can't pay, but it's great exposure. The sorry we can't cover travel expenses, but we're so looking forward to meeting you. I thought, well, at least I won't have to travel around the world at my own expense for a reading at a festival, only to discover no books were there. And I do mean around the world. It was a trip to Australia. But you know what? The little penguins made it all worth it. Yes, at least I won't have to drive half a day to that place where a book club hasn't read my book but someone else's. And no, I didn't write a character called Little Willie. But please do take 5 minutes telling me how much you hated Little Willie and how it was all my fault. No, please do go on. Yes, at least I won't have to spend a day on a train getting to a festival to find again no books were there, but this time there was also no moderator or any other panellists. And yes, we probably recognise those times when there is no audience. Well, at least. Oh, stop moaning. Because this is just the unprofessional stuff, or perhaps it's the professional stuff that you can say yes or no to. It's up to you. And we all have this, no matter what we do. We do, don't we? It's not just publishing. And surely there's enough of the good stuff, because there are some fantastic, passionate publishers out there, writers, festival makers, that make it all so worth it. Because these little incidents, these little mistakes aren't the point, are they? They're just the stuff. They aren't the writing, because these incidental other things come after the writing. And this is where the breaking back point comes. The niggle, the desire, the trigger. It's this trigger that matters. And mine was Iceland. A whole bloody country, it took that much. It was Iceland. Not coming here, not reading Icelandic writers, but in the first instance, hearing them, hearing of them. To me, it was music. And it didn't begin with Björk. It began with an American musician called John Grant. He was an alien in Reykjavik, singing the town, and it was the way he sang Iceland, his adopted country. Something cracked open in me, an imaginative gap, a step into the unknown. Through John, one night at his gig in a Galway club, I discovered his support band, a duo called Samaris, two very young women, one with a flute and the other with far too many high-tech machines that I couldn't name. I bought them a drink and we talked, and they were so young they called John's band Sold, and I laughed. On stage, they had a voice like a strange breath eaten up by machines, creating something I'd never heard before. And don't forget the flute. I jumped into the Icelandic music scene from my cottage in the Forest of Dean, and it was biblical. I mean this primarily in the Old Testament begat sense, because all of these bands are related, probably the low population in Iceland, and absolutely the music programme in Icelandic schools. Music is compulsory. So the begats, well, they began. Samaris begat Gangli, one of the very young women Jodafer fronted Gangli. Excuse my Icelandic pronunciation, it's probably revolting. Jodafer also begat Pascal Pignon with her sister, as well as begatting herself, clearly, with her solo stage name JFDR. And are you still with me? Deep breath. Gangli begat Singfang, or in truth Singfang begat Gangli, I don't know. And these names led to Mum, they led to Mammut, and they led to Junius Meyvant, who led to Prince Polo, who led to FM Belfast, who led to Rikke Vikkertu. Is it working on you yet, the sounds of these names with my awful pronunciation? Of course, I had no idea what most of these bands were telling me, but it was the sound of the words, both spiky and smooth, both guttural and trilling, that opened something up. I didn't write, not yet, but I listened and I listened and I listened. And then I began to read Sjón Gunnarsson. I learnt that Jane Smiley had spent her Fulbright year at the university in Reykjavik. I picked up her edited Icelandic sagas. And at last I came here. At first, I didn't come here to write. I came to Iceland Airways, the music festival. I wrote about that. A little like the music I was immersed in, I thought this place was something familiar, but at the same time, in the next glimpse, it was utterly unfamiliar. It was another planet. It's the light that strikes you first. It is another light. Light that I've never seen before. And don't forget, this is winter. There's not much of it. When the sunlight happens, it's like seeing with new eyes. It's seeing afresh, seeing clean. It is sublime. And yes, I am waxing romantic with a capital R. And yes, I do sound evangelical. I do sound rather self-help too, even a little Paltrow with the clean. But seeing the old, familiar world anew, isn't that what we as writers do? Isn't that what we need? We interpret the world around us afresh, as if we're seeing the familiar for the first time. And this is what we hopefully give to a reader. It tells a story, making that familiar unfamiliar and the unfamiliar familiar. And it makes the plain old world around us uncanny when we re-see, reimagine. And it doesn't have to be grand. In fact, it's usually better if it's as quiet as it can be. A single raven croaking from a yellow streetlight, a morning that is dark, a night that is green, a language that tickles at the edges of my imagination and wakes me up. I'm very glad I have the kindness of strangers to fall back on here in Reykjavik. And to take the Blanche Dubois nod just a little bit further, I am her age bracket after all, I'm going to take this breaking point and be more Blanche. I will stop moaning. Probably. I will hang up little paper lanterns over the glare of the bright realities of some moments of producing a book rather than the writing of it. And here, in this unreal place of Iceland and already in the dark, I will make this process of storytelling, this act of writing, just a little bit brighter, for me at least. Of course, I'll still be listening to Samaris and Gangli and a little bit of Mum. I still have no idea how to form the words of this country, and if you can't pronounce it pretty perfectly, Icelanders tend to stare. But that doesn't matter for now. I am at last forming my own words. But the raven is still there, croaking, whispering words of wisdom I can't quite fathom. Not yet.
That was Tiffany Murray. You can find out more about Tiffany on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 229, which was recorded by Kona McPhee and Tiffany Murray and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 230, former RLF trustee Maura Dooley speaks with Jane Draycott about her complex connections with her Irish heritage, reaching to the realm of the beyond when translating the work of Iranian poet Azita Gariman, and the unanticipated rewards of her residency at Jane Austen's Hampshire Cottage. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.